Hi, I'm Patrick Palm, and this is the Learn from Leaders podcast. In this show, I interview favorite customers and other interesting leaders in product development, marketing, HR, executive management, investors. You find favorite leaders in many different places and in organizations doing game development and publishing, software as a service and other tech companies and big enterprises, you know, going from very centralized command and control kind of organizations to a more modern way of working with a culture with high team autonomy and better alignment towards the company goals and values. So let's go.
Mark, what was your what was the biggest crossroad in your career?
I want to avoid the most classic one, which being obviously COVID and that whole change. But I think for me, it was really early on in my career, I was convinced that I would become an artist in the industry. I did some professional work in the industry as an artist, and then at some point realized that I am colorblind. Not to the point that it was an everyday exercise or like something that I would notice every day, but to the point where on a professional level, that was an actual hindrance. So that was obviously a major blow to, you know, like where I wanted to be in a career.
And I mean, you know, that's so interesting. I mean, talk me through like what happened. I mean, how did you know? What was your reaction when you realized that? And
it wasn't really like I've had an amazing art director for that project, and I forgot his god damn it. I mean, it's 15 years ago now. You know, my memory is not perfect, but we got feedback. I got several rounds of feedback that was always really specific about colors and tones, and at some point, I was like, talk me through this feedback. Like, why do I feel like I keep getting the same type of feedback from you? Like, why is color space always wrong? Like, why is contrast always wrong? So we went into that. And at some point in the middle of that call, he's like, could it be that you're colorblind? I was like, oh, I don't think so. Did a test afterwards. Turns out, yes, I am colorblind, not to an extreme level, but I have a contrast weakness. So I see all colors, but I have a problem with two contrasting colors that are close to each other or next to each other. So like a light yellow next to a light green. If they're separated by a distance, I see them both separately. If they're close together, they swim into one color for me. That was a blow because I studied. Right? I studied for artists. Like I've spent thousands of hours of learning how to paint, learning how to sketch. And then that came in. I was like, okay, cool. That's rough. Luckily, at the time, I also was already working kind of as a project manager for some of the art side of things at the same time. So that kind of was a natural progression for me to go into that direction. And honestly, nowadays, I'm happy I've gone through that change because it taught me one of the most important things, I think, in our industry is that something is always changing. There's something that explodes left and right. There's some major upheaval that is coming in all the time, and you need to be flexible in this industry.
So it sounds like, you know, when you look back at it now, it doesn't feel like you think about it as like a, let's say, called regret or so. It feels like it put you on a path that you know, maybe was meant to be, so to say.
Yeah, I generally like to look at life in ways of always looking forward, because there's always something that happens in the past that you could look at and you're like, oh God, I wish that wasn't the case. But to be fairly honest, something always happens. Like, because you wanted some candor stuff, right? My mother died when I was mid-20s. I was already working in the industry at that time, in the games industry. It was literally in a week where I slept under a meeting room table at a previous job because we were in the middle of a crunch phase when that whole thing happened, right? So it's changes like these that our industry keeps throwing at us, and it's stuff that we need to navigate, and it's the whole reason why we've changed so much around the way we're doing this company, like our company now, where we want to have people be open and honest with how they deal with changes and how we deal with changes and communicate those changes openly and publicly. Because I think with the world we have right now, it is becoming more and more important for leadership in companies and companies generally to take over some of the things that in the past we would expect governments to do, because that's just not happening anymore. Like as a company, we can't just sit down and say, we're only following the letter of the law and we don't care about our people outside of the commercial side of things. I think nowadays as company leaders, it is a moral and ethical requirement for us to do more. And I think that's part of what my experience in my life shaped me as well, is I was missing these type of leaders and I'm hoping to be one of them in the future. That sounded like a really marketing answer.
No, it did not at all, actually. And it sounds, it's a pretty big idea. I have had that conversation before, and one of the things I find is that people can have quite different opinions around this. So that leads me to ask you, you know, this view, is this something that you felt, you know, people around you, you know, fellow founders, you know, are buying into, or and you can kind of lead with this idea, or do you feel like, you know, you are, you know, the odd one out, and they're like, okay, yeah, you know, Mark, he can have his ideas, but, you know, let's just run the business, you know?
It's strange. I think a lot of times I've not yet found anybody that I would talk to, especially on the leadership side, that wouldn't generally be open to that. But there seems to be this idea that, well, it sounds like a lovely idea and we're all for it, but the reality of the of life doesn't allow us to that. And I don't think I agree with that. Like, I think if when you start a company as a startup, like if you have a startup, you start a company, you need to have these kind of ideas front and center. And I don't think it's a valid to say we can't do this yet, because I don't think you will ever be able to do it if you don't start with that in mind. You're never going to, like, in 20 years time, if you run a company, there's never going to be a point where you're like, oh, right now we feel like we're in a comfortable position where we can reevaluate what we've wanted to have this company be. It's either you live it from the very first moment or you never change it.
I can't help, you know, thinking, you know, you have this old conversation around, you know, games and art. I think and I hope we're over that now, that we can conclude that, you know,
Roger Ebert's games are not art.
Yeah. but let's, I think we're, you know, we paused that and we conclude that, games is art. And if we now have made that conclusion, well, if you look, I mean, art has always influenced society massively. And and of course, so, you know, art influences society and society influences art. So you have that whole cycle, and now games are part of that cycle. So I guess then what you're saying is it's kind of a natural consequence of where we are now, with a massive impact that games have in society, that, you know, you now have this power to influence society, and the question is, what shall you do with it? So that leads me then to, well, what do you want to do with it? Because now I conclude that you do want to influence, but can you share some of your thoughts around, you know, if your games can move the world in a certain direction, so, you know, what kind of impact would you like them to have?
Oh, that's a big question. I used to work in a company that would specialize in gamification. So I think my view on what games can do and can't do is probably a bit different, as in, I don't think games are a natural tool for us to educate specifically. Like, I think for education purposes, we have better tools, mentors, talks, podcasts, even like this, right? That's for me a good tool to educate. I think what games can do well and better than maybe a lot of other things is passively inspire. They can create wonder in people. They can create an interest in a topic. I don't think as a game director, I could make somebody care about something that they have no interest in, no matter what I'm doing with the game. But what I can do is I can awaken a spark in somebody. Like, I can show them, oh, this is something I've never known about, but I am interested. Give me the basics. Give me the baseline of what the vibe of this new topic might be, and then let them run off and ideally show them the path towards where they can go with it. I think games are the passive drivers, right? Games are the passive motivators. They're the things that you do as in your pastime when you want to relax from your work, from the craziness of life. So that's when you play a game. And I think in that role, we can't be forceful drivers, but we can create passions. We can create interest on things.
Yeah. I think we can talk about this for a very long time, but you mentioned, we kind of slid it into the whole topic of starting a company. Can you walk me through the decision process, you know, for you to start this new studio?
Yeah, so we've had, like, this is essentially the third studio now where I'm part of the leadership of the studio, and probably the studio where I have, outside of the first one, the most control as in the most guidance that I can put into the team or into the project. We have shareholders, we have a board of directors, we have like all of that, of course. But when it came to founding the studio, the one part that we wanted to push into it is we wanted to bring some of the almost old school nature of gaming back into the fold, where it used to be that every player had a slightly different experience in games. If you look at old games, like let's say, and then with old games, I don't even mean like the first round of games, but like Star Wars Galaxies, Anarchy Online, even some of the older MMOs, some of the older role-playing games, there was no expectation that you as a player will have the exact same experience as every other player in the game. Come kind of the time of World of Warcraft, it felt like there was this fundamental shift in how we approach games, where every single game out there had to have a way for every player to almost have the exact same experience. Everybody needed to be the hero that was able to defeat the very last boss in the game. Everybody needed to be the world-changing hero of everything. But that also caused for all games to start feeling more and more samey because you couldn't really have differences of experiences in it. So that was one of the things that in small pieces kind of guided us to creating this new studio. And it's part of why we called it Spectarium, which is, to be fair, not the greatest name, but the idea behind the name was something that was really important for us, which was the whole idea of an atrium, of an area that you spectate and you look at what the players are doing. And we wanted to have experiences in our games that people would want to watch back in their own heads of like, this was something epic that I have done. This was my achievement. It's not the same achievement as everybody else. This is something fundamentally that I as a player have done. And that's kind of the games that we want to create, and also the team that we want to foster is a team that has enough freedom to find ways of doing these kinds of experiences. Sounds super fancy. In short, it just means that we have a slightly different guide in terms of, yes, we want to have mass market appeal, but we want to have differences in storytelling for every single player that plays our games.
Why do you think it's not the greatest name? Because when I was just saying it in my head now, and I'm like, it's an amazing name. I might pronounce it wrong, but you could say it very casual, like, you know, Spectarium. I'm pronouncing it right?
Do you know what? You might be right. I think this is one of those, and I think this is another conversation we could probably have for several hours. This is probably one of those cases of what are we as a creator? Like if I as a creator look at something that we've created, am I ever happy with it? And I think you're right. Like I don't think Spectarium is a bad name. It might not be as catchy as like an apple or something else, but I think it does represent what we want to do. So I think you're right. I think this is more of a, you know, the game designer and me that's never happy with the things we're creating.
Yeah. I mean, when I play with pronouncing it differently, so I pronounce it like this, Spectarium.
Right.
It's like, you know, expectations are big.
I like that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's cool. You know, I hope you stick to it.
Yes, we are. We did make the conscious decision we're going to stick with it. Yeah. Part of it is also that we want our company to almost be like the driver behind it. And that's why Spectarium why you envision it as a Colosseum, as a building almost, because we want the game and the gamers to be the one that matters. We're essentially just putting in the infrastructure, right? Our games are the things that matters. Our players and communities are the things that matters to us. Our company and the team behind it is the building that is almost the passive thing around it.
Yeah. How long is it now since you founded the company?
So Spectarium, if I recall correctly, is around officially for about 2 years, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was your biggest fears? I mean, where, what was your hesitation? Because, you know, as you said, you know, this is not your first, rodeo, and you probably have some battle scars, you know, so I guess you had some hesitations.
Yeah, I think the biggest hesitation that we had for this project, and I think since then, we've seen that multiply the industry so much, is back then we've already realized that this might be the last hoopla that we as a younger company, as a younger, smaller group of company, of team can do to actually make a bigger hit, like a bigger production, because, you know, funding has become much, much harder. Generally getting noticed as a game has become much harder. And I think this company was like our last ditch effort of like, we're going to try one time to really go into the big leagues with the stuff that we want to do. To be fair, if I were to make a new company now, I'd probably be scared shitless. with how the world and how the industry currently is going when it comes to anything other than small indie titles at the moment.
But okay, so I have so many things I want to challenge you on there.
Please do.
So with the financing, and obviously since the absolute majority of my time I spent, you know, with Favreau, but I do have a small side business, an investment company. So I do a fair amount of game investment. So I see things quite a bit from that horizon. And I think I have enough data points to say that the tide is changing. I mean, might not get back to exactly where it was, but you know, just by looking at history, things have a tendency to over time simply become bigger. So I would say there's pretty strong arguments that, you know, funding opportunities will definitely be better than they have been for the last 12 months.
Yes, there will be new funding opportunities for sure, and the markets will hopefully come back. So obviously, it's like this industry has always been somewhat cyclical, but there is a difference in vibe is what I would probably call it in terms of how you get funding nowadays versus how you used to get funding. Like 10, 15 years ago, the way you would fund a new game is you'd have an amazing pitch, you would go to a publisher or a small investor, and you would get enough funding to at least get a good like vertical slice version out of the door or a demo version of something out of the door. With the escalation of cost, budget, and team sizes, this is becoming much harder nowadays.
Yeah. And I do want to get back to that in a second, but I just want to ask you about something else first, because you also you used other words, I think, but I think you touched upon discoverability, that it's getting harder.
Yes.
Which is a very known, I mean, that has been a big conversation the last few conferences I've been to, and in just one-on-one conversations I have too. It's definitely way harder to have people discover your game today than before.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, do you think it's that we end of a certain, let's say, cycle, and that better services, you know, there's going to be some changes in the market that's going to shift that.
Am I expecting that there's going to be a change to that?
Yeah, well, what I mean is basically, do you think it's just going to get worse and worse and worse, or do you think? I know this is not an opinion that everyone agrees with, but I mean, at least personally, I would argue that Spotify made discoverability better for me as a consumer, because suddenly I did discover a lot of stuff that I just wouldn't have discovered otherwise.
Yeah.
With the way that music distribution worked before, I simply discovered less music that I really like than I discovered today, and that is really thanks to Spotify's algorithms. And I'm just wondering, so that would be an example of where there were some technology shifts that made the trajectory change direction. Do you think we can look forward to something like that in the games industry, or do you think it's just going to get worse and worse?
I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, for the simple reason that as long as we have escalation in development costs, the discoverability doesn't quite keep up with it. And I think Spotify is a great example, right? It's like fundamentally the way you make music hasn't changed dramatically. So being able to find new songs on Spotify quicker is a good thing. That it does come with downsides, obviously. Like I know that I personally listen to a lot of stuff on Spotify that I couldn't even tell you who the artist is anymore. I just consume a single song because it's part of a curated playlist. I don't know who the artist is behind that anymore. And I think in the games industry, what we're looking at is escalation of prices to a point where discovering a game doesn't necessarily mean you're going to spend the money that we would need to be able to be spent on games for that to become a healthy environment, right? We see that on Steam nowadays. There is some type of Steam sale going on like every other day now. But it also means that the gamer community hasn't quintupled over the last couple of years, right? We are getting to a point where we have about as many players as we're going to get. Like, there's still some growth there, but we're now at what almost every other person in the world is now playing games. So I think we're slowly getting to a point where we have higher production costs, more games coming onto the market, no real good new tools to discover games, but also we have a capped ceiling of the amount of players in the market. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting one. I think quality will always survive. I think good, deep games will always survive, but I think the mid-core type of games will have a lot of trouble moving forward. And that, to me, is worrisome for the industry as large, because if mid-core studios, like if studios that do double-A quality stuff, if they can't survive, then we're missing the people that will become triple-A in the future. We're missing, you know, like the bread and butter, the core of our community in terms of the game developers. We're missing those because they don't have a chance to rise anymore.
Okay, you kind of gave me the perfect segue for the question I had in mind, which is I do want to talk a little bit about AAA and escalating budgets.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a given? There's a lot of, you know, AI obviously being very much on everyone's mind right now. Do you think we're getting to a place where we will be able to provide a AAA experience with actually, you know, maybe even smaller budgets?
I would love if that were the case. The problem that I'm seeing is that like, assuming let's go like perfect world, right? AI comes out and we somehow solved all the copyright issues and all the moral and ethical issues around it. Everybody's happy with AI. Let's assume that's the baseline, right? Nobody has issues with AI. AI is just a perfect tool that we can all use. Even looking at that, the only thing that I see in my head is what's stopping the big AAA companies from just using it in the same way and just making bigger games become even bigger, right? Like, I don't necessarily see AI as the thing that will make it easier for everybody. I just see that it's going to be an escalation on all fronts.
Mm-hmm.
But also, AI is expensive, right? Even in 10 years, AI will still be expensive if we're talking about large-scale efforts, which that just suddenly means that smaller studios, younger studios, like 2 or 3 people man studios, they won't have the budget to use AI in a way that will actually help them like be in a competition with bigger studios that have the budget to use AI on a grand scale. So I like the idea behind it. I think AI can be a really good boon to creative people generally, but I don't think AI is kind of like the one thing that solves all.
Let's stay on AAA for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you define yourself as a AAA studio, right?
We are kind of defining ourselves, I think, as a double A in terms of team size and budget, but we're aiming obviously for AAA quality in the specific areas that we feel valuable.
Okay. But then, you know, if we go a little bit deeper on that, so what does that actually mean? Because then, you know, there must be something that you do that allows you to make that leap.
Yes. And I think the part for us is that we are looking at scale in a way that we say we want to have quality in specific sections. And we kind of intentionally ignore other sections because we feel like for the games that we're making, that's not a priority of the player. So we don't necessarily have to care about that part of things too much. To give a specific example, Diablo 4 came out, right? One of the big changes between Diablo 4 and all the previous Diablo games was they went open world. I don't think that a Diablo 4 needed open world for it to feel like a Diablo game for the community at large. I think what they've done, and it's an amazing game, I love the game, but what they've done, if they created a large, almost empty world for no reason, I don't think any Diablo fan wanted to have a big open world to explore rather than the uniqueness, the intricateness of the really well-designed levels and dungeons of the previous Diablos. And that's kind of the way we're looking at things as well, is like we look at what is our game, like the game that we're building, what do we think the core audience really wants out of that? That's what we capitalize on, and we don't even try to just scale up for no reason. We don't try to do some like the Ubisoft open world thing of having 1,000 quests everywhere. That's something that Ubisoft can do with their scale. We can't. So we're not even going to try to get into that phase.
That's cool. I think you're onto something. And I do want to circle back to the technology thing. I mean, you know, I'm kind of clinging on to AI a bit here. But
yeah.
Do you also see that? Well, let's put it this way. Many game startups I'm talking to right now, both from a favorite point of view and from an investment point of view, they, you know, even with all the problems right now happening, they also like, no, this is the best time to start a studio because now we are at like a generational shift in technologies that will enable us to do a lot more with the same amount of resources, so it's like an interesting time to start a studio, you know, for that reason. And I have to say I like that pitch, and I like to then challenge them on that and see how deep it goes, basically.
Yeah,
you know, was it just, you know, a slide in the deck to have because they're they think they're supposed to, or have they actually really thought this through? You know, so you know, what's your approach there?
So to be fairly honest, like I think there's a preamble that I think we kind of missed as part of this discussion, because I feel like you and me were both well versed enough in the technology from the kind of the fundraising background and everything that we're kind of in our heads have it defined. But I think there's a big difference between what people assume we talk about when we're saying AI, right? So there's obviously like there's the content generation side of AI, like the Midjourneys, the DALLIs out there. There is the kind of the understanding and the logic side of AI with when we're looking at ChatGPT. But then obviously there's also just generally machine learning as a backing for like using logic or using content you've already made to make it better. And then obviously there's also the AI side on like KPIs and analytics that is really, really important and is massively growing. So I think all of these have a space and have a place. So for what I like about AI, and it's something that we are aiming and using in the company as well, is something that I like to call, we're trying to find the things that doesn't replace our people, but it enables us to do things that we just haven't been able to do before. And a part of that kind of comes back down to what can AI give us that as a smaller team of right around about 40 people, what is something we can do with AI that we couldn't be able to do without it? We can make awesome characters with AI, without AI. AI doesn't help us to make better characters. It might help us make more characters, sure, but not necessarily better ones. What AI does help us is create things like quests that are tied into mythologies, tied into histories of the real world, that if a player has an idea that, hey, I really like this type of content more than this type of content or that type of content, right? Then we can go and have an AI that drives it to make sure that they understand the player profile dynamically, give them better quests, give them better storylines that fits towards what that player wants. Still driven by our story, still driven by the stuff that we have defined, still driven by our content that we've created, but orchestrated and collected and collaborated in a way that it makes sense for that player's journey. So they still hit all the major beats of everybody else. They still play through the same story, but their daily quests, their daily side stories, their additional content around that might be slightly different because of the way that AI can collect that stuff together. Right?
Yeah.
We're building procedural dungeons in our case, right? So we know that we can have an unlimited amount of content. But AI allows us to collect that content in a way that we feel like for that specific player makes a lot more sense, right?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. You know, it's so much more than just, you know, hey, how can we crank out more assets?
Yes.
Yeah, cool. I want to go back. You know, this question might be, you know, this might be redundant taking what we just talked about, but I still want to do like a little bit like this is zoom out and kind of ask you as you know, if you don't mind me calling you an industry veteran. This is a bit of like a kind of like a, you know, state of the industry question. You know, how would you answer you know, what AAA used to be? What did AAA used to mean? What does AAA mean today, and what is AAA going to mean tomorrow? So, you know, again, you know, I'm not really in the like the nitty gritty of it here. It's really more from like an, you know, industry level perspective.
Yeah. I think if I want to talk, like maybe let's answer that from a player side first. For me, AAA used to mean something I've never even imagined possible before. Right? The first time I've played StarCraft, there was just nothing else quite like it. There were other strategy games, but nothing quite like that. The first time I've played Uncharted, right? That was amazing. The first time I've played Mass Effect, like these type of games were all experiences that I as a player have felt like I've not seen this before. Maybe something like it, but never quite this. There was always something magical that came with it. Nowadays, I feel like AAA has become so safe that a lot of AAA is just the same thing in a different clothing. Like we're now, 18, 19 iterations in, if not more, into Call of Duty. I don't even know how many into Battlefield. A lot of this stuff is... it's great. They're fun games. They have a place. I'm not hitting on anybody that hates those games. I still love playing them. But I think AAA has gotten so expensive and so slow and with so long development times that it was forced down the path of we're doing the super safe stuff. And the indie games are now where the magical things happen more than anything else. On an industry perspective, I think it is almost at a too big to fail level of budget and scale when it comes to AAA, where you can be an absolute veteran of the industry that has worked in the industry for 15 years and you might have two games on your belly. because you now suddenly work on a game like, I don't know, GTA 6 that probably has like a 7-year development cycle, if not longer, or the next Blizzard game that might have a 10-year development cycle and longer. And I think that's, in terms of AAA side of things, that's pushing the extremes. I don't think players need that or even want that. It's just that this was where the industry has devolved into.
You just made me... Oh, sorry. Maybe I interrupted you now.
No.
Well, I wanted to give you a chance to also talk about a little bit more about tomorrow.
A little bit about what? Sorry, coming in.
A little bit more about tomorrow, you know.
Oh, do you mean the future? Like, where does
yeah,
that...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, 5, 10 years from now, you know, how do you think we're going to... What is AAA going to mean for us?
I think AAA is going to mean a lot more of the... Just from a what is successful in the industry right now, I think it's going to look a lot more like, is Fortniteification a fair word for this? It's like games that are meant to be live service games that span a decade just because it's too expensive and too difficult to make a sequel of a sequel. So I think a lot more games are going to go down the route of, like, especially in the AAA market, I think they're going to go down the route of having a core name of a game and then kind of see if they can keep that alive for 10 years, 15 years.
So when I was when I got eager there and jumped in, interrupting you, you know, the question that popped up in my mind was around what you said, that you can be an industry veteran, you know, with, you know, 15 years experience, but you actually only have, only made 2 games. Mm-hmm. I think that was an interesting statement. And I want to bounce an idea with you. So I was moderating a panel, well, a fireside chat with two people, one VC as an investor and one head of production at the studio at the Nordic Game Conference. And we had a conversation there around why are production practices moving forward so slowly in the game industry?
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit frustrating, you know, when you are, you know, when you are doing, you know, what I'm doing with Favro, you know, because it's, you know, we've been designing a production platform for, you know, the future way of working. But when the future is coming relatively slowly, it's frustrating as an entrepreneur, right? You know, and I mean, we started this back in 2016, and we were just like, okay, the future is really just around the corner. I mean, because I had so many years of experience building Handsoft before this, we're like, okay, it's pretty clear how you're supposed to run a studio in the coming, you know, 10 years and what you need to do different. Right. And then that future, I mean, it is moving in that direction. This for sure, many students, especially startups that are working in better ways and, you know, taking advantage of all the, you know, better ways of working that Favro can enable that you can't do with things like, for example, Jira. But all in all, we are moving slow, and you can see that when you're also working with other industries like we are doing, where, for example, if I compare, let's say, you know, tech companies doing, you know, SaaS or, yeah, or fintech or whatever, and I compare to, you know, what did their, you know, practices for agile software development look like 10 years ago, and what do they look like today? There's a lot of change. You know, yeah, they have improved a lot. They have evolved. And a lot of these things have moved nothing in the game industry, and maybe even been going backwards now with the current crisis because people are very scared.
Yeah.
So anyways, what I wanted to get to here is that, you know, when you said that, I was actually realizing that because I've been thinking a lot about the reason, like, you know, why is this happening? Because we are an industry with absolutely brilliant people. You know, hardworking, creative, brilliant people. So it doesn't make sense that we're moving forward slow with production practices. So, you know, I'm very curious, you know, about, you know, the underlying reasons. And I just realized that, you know, one of those reasons might very well be that, you know, if you worked in a AAA production, that's always going to be prestigious. You know, that's always going to carry a lot of weight when you look for another job, etc. But if you only done 2 games, you know, you haven't really iterated much on you know, learning new things, versus if you've been at a company where over 15 years, you know, you have shipped, you know, 10 products.
Yeah.
You know, then you had 10, you know, postmortems to like figure out like, okay, how are we going to do this better this time? It's quite a big difference between 10 and 2. Yeah. So I think that, what do you think? Do you think this is one of the reasons why this is happening?
100%. It's simple things like, if you imagine you're planning out a bigger production just from an art asset perspective, right? You're suddenly dealing with thousands of, if not tens of thousands of assets. Making any change to whatever production flow you have already established is a daunting task, because you're suddenly looking at we need to build automations, we need to build migrations, we need to have all of these fancy things just to make a simple structural change to how we do production, right? So on a software product, I can make software products with a team of 5 people, like, right? And you can make them really quick. You have technology that is now made to be super fast and efficient to prototype things, to get us to a click dummy, to even to the point of, you know, if I want to sell a service nowadays, I can just go to any of the current website providers and spin up a website hosted by somebody else in 5 minutes, have a working shop with my banking details behind it and start selling stuff. Like that, less than a day for sure, and you have a polished experience that you could start your own business with. With games, that's just not a thing. Like the smallest task on a game takes ages just because of the amount of different complexity in terms of technology that needs to talk to each other. And, you know, like Favreau is a good example, right? Favreau is, and I don't mean this negatively, but Favreau is just the project management side. It's just the task management side. Any change we do in Favreau doesn't mean anything if that change isn't also represented inside of Unity, isn't also represented inside of whatever tool we're using to track art, isn't represented in any of the other processes, right? So it's always a case of you want to establish something simple. You want to make a simple change, but you look at that simple one-line summary of the change and you're seeing 3 months, 6 months, several years of work. That needs to change, in my opinion. I think we are at the point where the games industry has dealt so much with singular itemized tools that have no conversation with anything else that we're pretending like we have all these magical automations, but everything still is manual work between those. Right? It used to be that you had things like just RSS feeds that you could hook into and you could combine it with other RSS feeds to get intelligence out of it or make fundamental changes to it. Most tools nowadays don't even have a publicly facing feed that is open that you can connect to so you can have the same information going from one tool to the next tool. Even if they had it, they don't use the same standards. Unity doesn't care what structure a task in Favreau has. We can't change any of the, we can't take anything out of Favreau, make an automation that runs in Unity without us building it by ourselves, completely custom. So all of these type of things is, and it's not Favreau, right? It's every tool out there. It's every single tool out there is an isolated experience by now. It's to the point where separate services, like if this and that, came out because we needed these type of services.
Let's put it this way. I mean, your problem description is, I think, is correct. Since I'm on the solution side of this problem, you know, I have a somewhat more optimistic view. And if you don't mind, I'll give you my kind of short view there. I think, you know, it is something which is very hard. I'm obviously biased here with Favreau, but I would say, you know, that it's a bit more than let's say, you know, just the task management, because in many ways, you know, your workflows that you have are kind of like, that's like your way of working, which so it's very connected to, you know, like, you know, how does the people work together, and, you know, basically like how does this company operate. So if, you know, often when I help a customer set up Favreau, I often say that when you open Favreau, you want to recognize your game and you want to recognize the structure of your teams in how you set up the tool. If you've done that, you know, that's a good thing. And then hopefully, you know, you set it up, you know, you're aiming for something which is good. So I would say that it is, but again, you know, with disclaimer that I'm obviously very biased here, I do think collaboration platform is a little bit like at the heart of it, so to say. You know, you can have a lot of, you know, executive level initiatives around how you're going to have a better culture, you know, how you're going to have better leadership, you know, how you're going to, you know, shorten your art pipelines. How you're going to have more, you know, collaborative art pipelines. This is something I talk a little about right now. But none of that's going to work unless, you know, you have it set up. You have a tool that actually supports that. But, you know, just to slide slightly away from Favreau, what I would like to say is that, what's interesting, and I think this is where it's also a great opportunity for the studios that get this right in industry, and that is that, I mean, all of this stuff is very hard, but if you are putting in the effort to really optimize how you can iterate with, you know, your whole tool chain, I mean, now I'm not talking just Favreau, I'm talking about everything, like you described yourself. If you're putting a lot of effort into, like, you know, how can we make this company basically as, you know, iterative as possible, and you know, you are putting yourself way above the rest, which is going to give you an advantage in the market. And to quote, you know, Sam Altman here, I think he said something like, the faster a company can iterate, you know, the more, you know, powerful it will be, the more successful it will be. Yeah. I'm probably misquoting him, but it was something like that. And you know, he's absolutely right. You know, I mean, that's basically what, you know, business agility means. And if you are actually investing, if you have a strategy around what that means, and you're putting into work, you know, fixing a lot of those things, you know, the rewards are massive. And I think that's the biggest problem right now, is that everyone is right now in such a state of fear. Yeah. And everyone's just like heads down and not thinking around, like, how can we, you know, is there an opportunity to do things, you know, way better? Or to put it in more business terms, you know, how can we, ship, you know, better games faster, you know, which is, you know, kind of our slogan, you know, but that's really what it's down to, you know. So there's a great opportunity here. And I think that now, when the tide is a bit like starting to turn, you know, the ones who's going to come, you know, fastest out of the gates, you know, that's going to be tomorrow's winners. But, you know, and, you know, production rent.
I think there's a case there, like, from, because I'm kind of curious, because obviously you mentioned you have I know that of your funding background as well and your fundraising background as well. I'm curious because obviously when we talk to VCs and general investors, a lot of the focus is on purely the player facing data side of things, right? Like day one retention, KPIs of that sort. They all make sense to me, but the part that I've never really been asked in all of the years of talking to every single investor, I think, under the sun by now, is any proof of efficiency of the company or the team, which I always found interesting because really, as an investor, obviously you're hoping that the first hit becomes a hit, right? The first game that you come out is the big thing and you get making your 10x back and whatever. But realistically speaking, we all know that likely the first game that any company does is going to burn, right? It might be the second or the third game out of it. So I'm always curious of why that doesn't seem to be a focus. Like, why is there no standard of judging a team based on efficiency metrics of within the team? Like Favreau, for example, you guys have tools, dashboards that any investor could look at to see, hey, does this team actually have good structures? Does this team have good management in place? Does this team have sprints? And like, what is their burn-on chart looking like? Not saying that all of teams need to do that, but I'm always curious of why that just doesn't seem to be a thing.
Yeah. I think the reason is that you need to do an informed judgment on that. You need to go quite deep, and I think you're getting outside of the comfort zone of what many investors wants to do. And I think, and I'm gonna give like 3 points here to nuance this a bit. So I think the proxy metric that is being used is really team. And this is pretty classic. I mean, not all, but most investors, they really, you know, if you look at the investments in new game studios, I mean, the favorite case is typically basically all dogs doing new tricks. So, you know, yep. A team that's been doing, well, you know, some veterans have been doing some amazing stuff before. Now they're spinning out because they have this great idea. You know, they're also going to recruit some, you know, very, you know, upcoming strong talent. But fundamentally, it's kind of like old dogs, you know, doing a new trick, and I'm not sitting with any good data on this, but I most investors I speak with are pretty convinced that there are good data saying that those startups are basically much more successful. One of the things that you do have metrics on is that this is a classic. This is like. You know, all tech, which is that, you know, someone who's a first-time CEO versus someone who's a third-time CEO. The third-time CEO is going to be spending way more money faster, you know. Yeah. but so it's going to be a more expensive investment, so to say. But a chance of success is also much higher because, you know, they've done it before.
Yeah.
So you have that. So what I think is the case when you might want to look a little bit deeper at it, you know, the way you describe, is when you are having a team which is quite junior, because there are teams that are junior that are getting funded, and there are some fantastic successes that have come out of teams that are, you know, basically straight out of college. And If you have a team like that, you know, then probably you would like to interview them a little bit more, you know, hands-on on, okay, so how are you actually going to run this? And kind of look at that as you move forward. There's also always, I mean, and this is also something that is debated, and that is that, you know, how much coachability do you want in an entrepreneur? So some investors are like, okay, we want an entrepreneur who's very coachable. But then you have other investors who say, like, well, the best entrepreneurs, they're pretty stubborn, so they're not going to be very coachable, you know? So there's always that debate, you know, and I think, you know, maybe, I don't think this is the right answer to this, but and different investors are going to have a different style.
Yeah,
and sometimes, you know, things are just, you know, in Senate and things work out. But you know, maybe one idea could be that if you have a more junior team, you would like to look a little bit for coachability, because then you could, if you have some senior people on the board, et cetera, or someone from the investor who has maybe a production experience and can actually be relatively hands-on, it can help them avoid some of the typical pitfalls. And I'll say one more thing on this. It is quite common that startups are doing some quite damaging mistakes around production. I mean, the classic case, if I look at this from a tool point of view, is that, you know, just when they start, they're like as lightweight as they can. You know, maybe they're using, let's say, Notion, and that's it. But then they feel like, oh, you know, we don't want to have too much management, so just stick with that and stick with that. And then suddenly, you know, the 30 people, you know, this is not a small thing anymore. And then they're like, okay, shit, you know, we need to run this like a proper company now. And then, you know, they hire a producer person that are coming from a big publisher and have very old school practices. And then they put in Jira, and suddenly, you know, this company is very, 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 you know, bureaucratic and kind of feels like big corp, you know, you kind of kill all of that entrepreneurial feeling. So the trick here is, of course, that you want to think a little bit ahead, you know, you want to, you know, start a little bit earlier to think, you know, how can we get some lightweight processes in here, supported by the right kind of tools, that would be right for us now, but will actually also scale quite nicely, you know. This is obviously a very thinly veiled, you know, favor pitch, but it you know, with favor, without favor, you know, you know, just you know, paying attention to those questions and having a little bit of insight. And it might be that if you never experienced, you know, this kind of crash and burn, you know, then it's really nice to have someone who can advise you on it, who can tell you, okay, this is what's going to happen when you go from 10 to 20. And when you go then from 20 to 30, you're going to run into these problems. And then we go from 30 to, let's say, 100, then you're going to have these headaches. And there are ways to remedy that, you know?
And learning what lessons you... The earlier you do something, the bigger impact it's going to have later. And the later you do other things, the more horrible that impact can be as well. It's like it's one of the things that you learn from experience of, do we care about this or this more than something else? And I think it's something that, especially when you're looking at younger startups, that's probably where a lot of the pitfalls come in. It's like, hey, do we really care? Do we need a document that defines this stuff? Nah, we're just thinking, yeah, we don't care. And then they blink their eye, and suddenly there are 30 people who are like, ah, crap, we should have done this like 3 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, do you find, because very often I was recently on the Building Better Games podcast, being interviewed by, you know, Ben Karcic, and I really like their podcast. I think it's amazing. And they often talk about alignment, and you know, they often talk about how one of the biggest issues in a studio of some size is that if you ask a coder, like, you know, what is this game about? You know, what's important? You know, they can typically not really answer. So you know, the whole kind of like alignment is, I guess, relatively easy when you have five guys in a room. But when you get bigger, it's really hard. And it's one of the things that actually makes a very big difference to how it's going to go. And I would really like to hear your thoughts around this, and also for a very specific reason, because you said you want to be very focused on where the AAA, you know, effort is, or the AAA, you know, part is.
Yeah.
And that requires a very high level of alignment. So, you know, you must have been thinking a lot about this, or have you?
Yeah, it's to be fair, honest, like, obviously there's a couple of ways that you approach it from a directorial level. Like for me as a kind of design director on a team, one of the things that was important for me is that we look at the feature set of the game in a way that we base it on commonalities, like a common theme that we have everywhere in our game. This doesn't mean anything to you, and it won't mean anything to the listeners here, but there's a feature set that we have in our game that we refer to as infusion, which is something that is essentially just allows players to change certain aspects of their build. So whether it's the Diablo style, put a gem into your weapon, and that weapon now deals fire damage type of thing. But we use that same idea in multiple places of the game, but it's part of our core experience for the player. So that also helps if instead of having a laundry list of 50 features that are all separate from each other, find the highest big bang for your buck type of features and make sure that they're related in spirit to each other. So you don't have to rely on everybody on your team to understand every single feature you have, but rather understand the broad basics, the foundational pillars of features that underline everything else. So I think that's part one, is it takes time for a team to grow to a place where you can make really complex games with a lot of features, figure out the core features and focus all your attention on that, even if it might feel at the beginning of the game development that like, why would anybody play this? This is so simple. This is so easy. Well, because you start off easy, right? You can always add complexity throughout the development. You start with the simplest features that you can find and then expand on that front. So that's one part that helps. The other part, though, that is, I think, tremendously difficult and especially super difficult for new people and younger people coming in the industry is the reality of it is that alignment doesn't happen magically. As a matter of fact, I'm currently working on an update to our art Bible, which is not even my job technically. I'm just helping our art director a little bit. As part of that, I did an investigation on core pillars of other games again, just to make sure that I still have the right understanding of what our core pillar should be. I looked into a core pillar from Destiny 1, and Destiny 1 had 7 core pillars, because Bungie always has 7. That's their thing. 2 of those, I don't think were Destiny 1 at all, but they were still part of the core pillars. It's just that over time, over the development time, they kind of went away from that. But it was so important to them in the beginning of the development that was a core pillar for them. Once the game came out, it was pretty clear that those 2 core pillars weren't part of the DNA of that game at all. And I think that's important as well. It's alignment is one of those, in hindsight, 2020 things. Everybody says, oh, we should have had better alignment at the beginning. But the reality is, the alignment that you're seeing at the end of the game is because you went through the entire production cycle. It's because that changed 18,000 times throughout development. I think that's something that sounds so nice from industry professional to say is like, yeah, you need a great art Bible, you need a great design Bible from the very beginning, and it needs to be perfect. It's part of the pre-production. No, it can't be. Unless it's the 7th game in a series, then yes, you can probably have a decently good design Bible, a decently good art Bible. If it's the first game in a series that you're building, you have no idea what your game is going to be about just because you've done a pre-production, just because you've done it for 6 months. Your development cycle is 6 years or more or less, depending on the game, right? You need to be open to understand that not everybody in your team has the alignment. So you need to trust on a few people in your team to be the vision keepers of having that alignment. And you need to understand as a leader, their alignment is different from my alignment. Like, I understand that my art director is probably having a slightly different game in their heads visually than I have, but that's okay. We'll align to that. We'll figure it out as we go. Like, we'll see concepts that I thought would be slightly different. That's okay. I'll accept those concepts. We're going to modify some other things so that we together as a team over time develop that common understanding that it's much stronger than a forced alignment at the beginning of the game.
That's so interesting. How you're distributed, right?
Yes.
As a team. How do you, what's the difference in how you, well, let's, if I take a step back, you know, what you just described, I think is very interesting, and I think it's very wise, and it's also very ambitious. What's the difference in succeeding with this in an office environment compared to being remote?
So I think in an office environment, and that was a conscious choice from my side, but also the side of the team very early on, is that we understood that if you are in an office environment, you can be much more directorial with the way you're approaching game development, right? You can guide the minutiae of every decision much more just because you have so much more contact with each other. You are in the same presence so much more, which means that smaller decisions are much more easy to align between everybody than it is in a completely work-from-home environment. I think in a work-from-home environment and a distributed environment as we're doing, you need to allow for flexibility. You need to understand that whereas before I might be thinking that a design director is like 70% of the design of the game, right? In a distributed environment, it's probably more like 50%. I think a Hideo Kojima level of game probably shouldn't or doesn't really come out of a super distributed environment, because in for directors like that, they need much, much more control over every single piece for that whole thing to work. So I think there is a case for specific games are catered more towards distributed environments than certain other games. If it's the more you go to a very linear, very distinct experience of a game, like a movie almost, I think it's going to be much harder in a distributed environment. If you're fine with, and if you have an amazing team and you trust your amazing team, and if you're fine with them making their own choices, that is, I think, a measure of success for your distributed teams.
Okay, so this actually then, there's a bit of, you know, a fit between type of game and distributed versus in office. That's a very interesting point.
I don't think it's impossible, by the way, to do any of this, but I think it's, you're hurting your own level, your own chances of success a little bit if you're not conscious of that difference. There is a difference. Pretending to say that there is no difference, I think that is what can be really disastrous to the team morale, to the project itself.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, I agree with you that you know, both can be possible. But I'm intrigued by the potential, let's say, force multiplier effect here. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you're then? Let's, you know, can you tell a bit more about, you know, what is it you're gaining? So what's the, you know, what's the right team member in a remote team? You know, how is the right team member there different from the right team member in an office environment? And what would be the advantage of being distributed and having that person in connection with the type of game you're making? That's a lot of questions in one, but they're connected.
No, I think I get what you're asking. So I think in remote studios, the biggest challenge, and that's possibly a thing that generally is even worth its own podcast, I think, at some point, is there is a big challenge in remote teams, which is coaching and working with juniors is much harder. So naturally, the tendency, and we see that for our team as well, the natural tendency in terms of the teams that work really well with distributed teams is people that have experience, and ideally people that have both professional experience in bigger studios, but also come from a startup environment or have worked in a startup, so that they need less stringent guidances and less strict design boxes around them. So people that have just a really great fundamental understanding of what works in games and what doesn't along every team member. We have amazing concept artists in our company that we don't need to give a lot of guidance to. I've been reviewing a concept art for a boss character in our game today, where it's looked at and it's like, there's nothing I could say from a design director perspective that would improve on the design that I was presenting outside of like subjective things on it. Like, I personally would like it to be blue instead of green type of thing, right? But objectively speaking, that is a masterclass of a character design. So if you surround your team with people like that, that you know you don't have to guide, they will guide themselves, maybe not quite where you want them to go initially, but somewhere better, somewhere you couldn't think of, and you let them run with it and you trust your team, I think that's where a lot of the magical parts can come from.
Cool. Is there a difference in recruitment?
Yes.
Yeah, is there a difference, like, how to recruit, you know, the right people for a distributed first team? Is there a difference where you find them?
Well, I mean, distributed teams obviously means that we have the advantage of hiring anywhere. But I think it's really hard. And I don't think we are doing a fantastic job at our company, to be fairly honest with hiring. And I don't think most companies don't necessarily do that either. But hiring in distributed teams is really, really hard, because in an interview, you only see so much of a person. If you were to meet a person in the office, ideally, even if you have them in the office for like a couple of days, even as like a 3-day working trip, unless obviously they're already, you know, like employed somewhere else, and obviously you can't do that. But generally, I think if you meet somebody in person and spend a couple of hours with them in person, that tells you a lot more about the character than if you do interviews. For interviews, though, what then matters is that we start smaller than I would normally do. Like, the first interviews that we have with people now is usually a one-on-one with me or my co-founder with that person. It's because the first thing that we need to check for before we even check skills is cultural fit. Do they fit to this environment? Do they fit to an environment that they have a little bit more leeway? Do they fit to an environment where maybe not every single task is predefined to the umpteenth detail already, because that's not what we're doing? Like, it's, do we find people that are fine with approaching others in a team directly without even having to go through their managers, because that's a really, really heavy time consuming thing if you do that in a distributed environment. So we're looking for people that are much more self-driven and that are happy with working in a team with other people that are self-driven, where they don't have to adhere to the perfect hierarchy every time, where it is absolutely fine for an artist to go to a developer and just ask them questions. It's this type of people that we've noticed are really hard to find when you're looking at established studios, because established big studios do not want that type of person. They often want people that just follow exactly what the workflow says, follow exactly what the hierarchy says. And it can be a daunting change in structure when they start working for a more agile team that is open to them having more choices.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, how does it affect leaders? Do you have that challenge already now that you need to think around, team leaders, how their leadership is different? Have you reached a point where you need to coach, leaders, and you need to think like how will they be different, distributed versus
100%, 100%, yeah. and in dramatic ways, right? If you talk to somebody one on one, even on a camera, you are missing so much subtext of emotions and the way they're doing, like, because you only see them for that specific meeting on that specific day, right? You don't know how they were behaving in the office 5 minutes beforehand. You didn't meet that same person for a coffee chat just randomly the day before or on that day in a hallway somewhere, right? So as a leader, you must be so much more conscious about what does my message mean to the person I'm talking to right now. It's not even empathy. It's more directly understanding, if I treat it as the worst case scenario, how would that person understand what I'm about to say to them? Not because the person wants something bad to me, but because I can't guarantee that my understanding is the same understanding as a person that I'm talking to as part of a Slack call somewhere. So that's, I think, a big change for leaders to kind of wrap their head around, is that they need to be not just great communicators and not just great leaders, but also like understanding of almost like a psychotherapy level of understanding of what is happening with the person they're talking to right now, what is happening in their home, because there is an advantage that is not often spoken about and a disadvantage at the same time with when you're working from home. The disadvantage is you are home, which means if you have a problem at home, if your kid is sick, if you have relationship issues, if whatever else happens at your home, you're still sitting in that potentially temporary negative environment. If you're currently having a fight with your wife or your partner at home and you're going through a divorce at home, that is all there in the time that you're working for a company.
Yeah.
If you're working in a company in a physical office, you have that physical distraction of like that distance there. All of that is stuff that leaders nowadays need to be acutely aware of.
Yeah. That's a really good example. If you have someone in the team,
yeah,
that have that challenge that, they're going through tough things at home. How do you, from a manager point of view, from like a company point of view, how do you, what's your recipe for how to support that the best?
Right. So that's interesting, because I can actually bang Favreau's drum here a little bit. So one of the things we've done it was actually shortly before COVID, and then we kind of kept expanding on that even after the whole COVID lockdown happened, is we hired somebody who has a fancy position of the feel-good manager. That person is somebody that's essentially outside of our HR structures. They have a written document and the repeated information from my side that anything that is being told to that person is being told to that person in confidence, unless the employee they talk to has specifically asked them to share the information to other people. What that person's job, Jörg's job, is in our team, is then to take that information and, if need be, again, after checking in with the person, if need be, to put that on what we call our feel-good board, which is just a closed-off private Favreau board that's essentially just has a listing of the people that we have in the company and names on it. And it has three basic columns. And the columns are physical, work, and I think a general thing. And then the only thing that Jörg does with that board is he essentially assigns, like, hey, this specific employee physical is medium right now, which just means that there's something at his home going on or in his private life going on that means that physically he's not up to 100%. We don't care about the details. I don't know if somebody is has a terminal illness or anything else, I just know that our manager should probably, for that period of time, as long as that person is on physical medium or whatever, should probably make sure that we don't overwork them, that maybe check in with them if they need some longer breaks, or maybe check in if they want to have some vacation days or any of that kind of stuff. Right? We have a comment section in there where anonymized, we share comments of if people have issues with anything, really. What it just allows us is that only on the high level, like the very high level of their direct supervisors, is it allows them to understand the subtext that you as a manager might not have because you're not sitting with them in the same physical office. So it's the job of our field manager, as well as the job of every one of our leads, our principals, our directors, to have regular chats with every single one in their team, and then kind of just filled out that feel-good board afterwards. We don't share details. That's the important part. It's just the vibe that they're getting from that person so that everybody else on the team on that leadership side knows, okay, this person is going through something. I don't need to know what it is they're going through, but it's something bad that they're going through. So I'm going to make sure that this week I might not invite them to horrific feedback conversations about their job performance, or I won't invite them to 3-hour-long, really in-depth meeting about something if I can help it, right? It's this level of making sure that we surface what is happening on the team so that their supervisor and their team leads can see that and understand on whether or not they can rely on that person in the same way they usually do, or whether or not there is something that they need to keep an eye on.
That's a really good practice. On the same theme, do you actively support team members using like a nearby kind of co-working space or some kind of, so they can do that kind of like not work from home but work from somewhere else, or do you leave that entirely to the team member? I mean, I've seen many variants of how companies deal with this.
So it's interesting. I've pitched this to everybody on the team multiple times already. It's like, hey, if you want to do any of this kind of stuff, let us know and we can see something, we can look into it. Mostly what happens is that we have maybe a team member that says like, hey, I'm going to actually work from a hotel in the city today because maybe I have construction at home, or maybe something else. Or, lately in countries like Spain where the heat is so stupidly high that they might do something of that sort. One of the other things that we're offering to everyone on our team and our field manager's job is to make sure that they actually kind of follow up on that and see if they want to do that, is we're offering both big company events. So for example, in November, we're flying the entire team, whoever wants to, not everybody is comfortable with it, but everybody is comfortable with it. We're flying them all to Lisbon for a week-long team event of not a lot of work goes on there. It's just a team event to make sure that people have FaceTime with each other, can engage with each other, can have some fun and some kind of just venting time and kind of just emotional support time with each other. But on top of that, we also are offering every single one of our employees the chance to meet other employees if they feel like that's worth it. And it's just a message to our field managers, literally just, hey, Jörg, I would really like to meet, let's say our lead environment artist would really like to meet two of his environment artists. They can just send a message to our feedback manager saying, like, I would like to meet these two people. And the only message they're going to get back from Jörg is, cool, when do you want me to book the hotels and when do you want to book the flights? They don't have to take care of anything else. That's all done by our admin team. And we want to make it as simple as that for everybody in the team moving forward.
All right. I want to go back to something you talked about before, because I have a question, and it's almost like a potentially sensitive topic, but I find it interesting.
Sure.
So when we talked about face to face versus being remote, we talked about how the communication that disappears, how much that you're not getting when you're not face to face, So mm-hmm. So we talk about it as a limitation, and that's probably the baseline conversation here. But one thing I've been reflecting a bit upon is that I think this is partly down to specific people, and it's partly down to situations, and of course a combination of the two, where sometimes I think some people can be better at what they do when they don't need to be face to face.
Yes.
Some people get... I'm really trying to stay away from stereotypes here. So, someone who basically gets... who is very brilliant at what they do, but the whole process of social interaction is, for whatever reason, you know, making them nervous or uncomfortable, and basically taking a lot of their CPU.
Yeah.
So you know, all of their attention is just going to the social interaction because they're maybe not entirely comfortable in that. Or actually maybe the other way around. Maybe they're too comfortable in it. So they're like a little bit too happy about it. They're like you know, like drunk on social interaction.
Yeah.
Which is actually hindering, you know, their brain to be focused on the thing that they're really good at. So basically what I'm trying to say is that I do think there are situations where some situations where some people will actually be better at what they are supposed to be doing when there's actually no face-to-face. They're just, you know, over voice or maybe not even that, just over Slack, you know?
I mean, it's a common theme that we've heard from almost every single one of our developers, for sure. It's like, whenever we made that change to like work from home, a lot of their productivity kind of skyrocketed because, you know, as a developer, if you're in the zone and somebody just walks by and just sends throws a side comment your way, you might be pulled out of a thought process that you've been like spending an hour on just getting into it. And now you're completely taken out of it. I think that's definitely one of those cases that we've noticed a lot is that like, if you are required to have focus in your work, it's so much easier if you're working from home.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is very interesting. I think this is often forgotten, actually. You know, when we're talking about the benefits of remote work, there's a lot of other stuff that we're talking about. But I think this particular aspect, I think, is very important. And it's really cool what you're doing, that you're combining, that you are getting together as well. Because then you are getting, you know, you're getting a lot of focus work in there, but you're also getting, you know, the social aspects as well. So people actually get to know each other, you know, in that way. So yeah, it sounds like you have a very, very exciting thing going.
And I mean, I think the part that is just not generally not talked about enough in these kind of situations is a soft cap for this conversation as well, is we are getting things wrong all the time. And I think as one of the things that I would like to impress on, you know, if somebody listens to this at some point and they're like, okay, I'm like in a 10-man studio or a 5-man studio and I'm trying to grow larger sizes, especially with work from home, you're going to get shit wrong more than you're going to get stuff right. The important part is that you kind of keep trucking forward and you keep looking into, oh, this went wrong. What can we do next and how can we make it better? Don't look too much into this sucked and blow up on people of why this sucked. Just look into what can we take out of it? What can we make it so that we can do a single step better next time? You're always going to do two steps back and one step forward sometimes. But as long as you kind of balance it out and you're sometimes doing just one more step forward and you're doing one more step back, that's already a win in my book. It is so hard to make games in the first place. It is so hard to make companies in the first place. It is even harder to make it all when you work in distributed environments from home with strangers you might have met 3 times in your life. Understand all of that. Understand that that is a challenge in itself. That is absolute masterclass if you get that right. We haven't gotten it right everywhere yet. We're working on it. We're hiring the right people to do it. But it is hard. And I think that is, and you're going to fail, and you might fail 2 times. You might even fail with your first company. You might even fail with a third company. But it is important to understand that nobody got this right the first time, no matter what they tell you in often like in public speeches.
Yeah, I think that's so right. And I would add that you don't even have to get it right. You just have to get it right enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the good news here. You know, if you get it right enough with the right thing, that's enough for success. So you know, you don't need to be like 100% to be successful. You know, you just need to get you know, the right things right, and you're going to have success.
Yes.
Cool. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Likewise, this was fun. Like, this is the first podcast I've done without face, and it's fun. So much more relaxing.
All right, cool.
I hope you liked that interview. If you did, you know what to do. Share it on your favorite social media so others can learn from the Favor community.